Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
This week on Behind the Knife, we actually have a very special guest, Dr. Al Beakley, who's going to talk with us on a very interesting topic, specifically on his experiences in a combat environment in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as taking care of a very important individual. Hope you enjoy this very unique and interesting story as much as we did when we first interviewed Dr. Beakley. Enjoy.
So I'm very pleased to have a good friend and mentor of mine, Dr. Alec Beakley, join us here on Behind the Knife, who is an associate professor of surgery at Thomas Jefferson in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Al and I go way back to West Point together. We're residents together, and then he was one of my mentors in staff and one of my mentors in life throughout this entire process. Al, welcome to Behind the Knife.
I certainly am surprised and honored to be here. Thanks a lot, Scott.
So obviously you're here with the four of us at Academic Surgical, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But I know you very well, but our listeners don't necessarily do that. Where are you from? How'd you get to the point? And tell us a little bit about your background, because we're going to delve a little bit about some very unique experiences that you had today.
So I grew up in Ohio, Toledo, Ohio, and I went to West Point for undergrad, where at one point I was Scott's company commander during its second year summer. I didn't really remember Scott from there, but he certainly remembered me. And then I went to Case Western on a health profession scholarship, and I did my training at Madigan Army Medical Center, where I ultimately met and became very close friends with Scott. And then from there, I spent a year at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and then went back to Madigan as teaching staff. And spent most of my Army career there, which included three deployments to operations Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom. And then my service commitment ended in 2010, and I was fortunate enough to take a job at Jefferson, where I continued to do what I did in the Army, which was trauma, bariatric surgery, and general surgery.
So Al, I want to touch, before we talk about a little bit about your deployments, I want to touch a little bit about the unique aspects of your job to date. And specifically, we have a lot of different people ranging from medical students to residents to people early in their careers all the way up to chairman of surgery. And like you said, you have a very unique job in that you split your time between acute care surgery and trauma, as well as have this entire other bariatrics practice. What advice would you give to people who have that same situation, maybe are looking for a job where they're able to do a lot, and not necessarily in the community hospital. They don't go to Monaco, Wisconsin, where I grew up, where maybe that's feasible, but at a major academic center, what advice going through this process would you give them?
Well, I think it's difficult, and I continue to struggle to find the balance between the two things that I love to do. I will be free in admitting that I think I became very lucky at having, it was a unique set of opportunities where Jefferson had an opening for a bariatric surgeon in a fairly young bariatric program, and that I was also hired on the trauma service based on my my background and my experience in the combat trauma. And so some of it is, as Gene Moore was saying in his lecture today, where he received a Lifetime Achievement Award, it's a matter of timing. That being said, I think it's very important that you play to your strengths, and that if you want to do something, that you sort of fight hard to do those aspects of your career and those aspects of your field that you enjoy. I've managed to make it work, I continue to try and do well in both those fields.
So you've clearly been, you know, very successful both in academics and clinically, and in your current position. What advice would you give people who are coming out of residency right now who, you know, want to end up at an academic center, want to do these type of things, versus with regards to pursuing a fellowship, training, or staying as a more, you know, broad general surgeon?
I think the reality of academic training nowadays is that I think fellowship training is almost a must. Now, the military affords some opportunities to get a lot of on-the-job training and stuff, and that, in my case, went a long way. I'm as I told Scott yesterday, I'm the only bariatric surgeon at Jefferson that's not bariatric fellowship trained, and I'm the only trauma surgeon there also that's not trauma trained. But I think I'm lucky in some respects, and I do recommend for those that are interested in going into an academic setting, particularly at the bigger universities, I think fellowship training nowadays is almost a requirement.
So, Dr. Beakley, one of the reasons we have you here is to hear about your combat experience. Can you just give us a brief overview of your career in the Army, how many times they deployed you, where they deployed you to, and then kind of what kind of traumas you were seeing?
So my first deployment was with the 102nd Forward Surgical Team. It was to Kandahar Airfield. It was in the fall of 2002 into the spring of 2003. At that time, most of the fighting to rid the area of the Taliban had concluded at that time, and there were still some areas of activity, mainly with special operations that we were supporting. We were attached to the 82nd Airborne Brigade that was at Kandahar Airfield, but a lot of the trauma that we were doing at that time was sort of random, random street violence. In one case, I remember the instance we had two Afghan farmers that got into a fight over a patch of carrots and sort of were stabbing each other with swords and knives. Many instances, probably about once a week, where we had someone come in as a landmine victim, oftentimes a young boy herding goats that would pick something up off the ground and blow a hand off or have another injury. So that was most of what we were dealing with. There was some violence between Afghan militia forces and some of the other bad elements at the time, but a large counterinsurgency and fighting with the Taliban like we've since seen was not going on. And to give you an example of numbers, for the 7 months that the forward surgical team was there was only 112 cases, I think, so not a huge experience. However, in 2004, I was deployed with the 912th forward surgical team, initially to a place about an hour south of Baghdad, where, again, at the forward surgical team level, relatively few cases, but very high intensity sort of cases when they did come in. And then I spent another 6 months at the 31st Combat Support Hospital in Baghdad at Ibn Sina Hospital, where I think in those 6 months I personally did over 300 cases, and the cache for the year did over almost 3,400 cases. So very, very busy trauma setting.
Before that time in your career, had you dealt with major trauma, and then how did you learn to adapt to that?
No, and if you think about, when I think back on what we did as for trauma experience, most of my trauma experience had been in during my residency, and as an attending at Madigan, I think back, we took home call probably 4 or 5 times a month. It was a level 2 trauma center. Of our cases that we had yearly, I think only 3% of them or less were operative trauma. So you can imagine that's diffused over several attendings taking call 5 times a month. So the number of actual operative trauma cases I did in those 3 years following my residency is relatively limited. So as Matt, my colleague and our friend Matt Martin said, even a fellowship-trained person from L.A. County said didn't feel necessarily prepared when he got there to deal with the combat trauma. What I would say is the Army trained us very well, and you fall back on fairly basic principles. Now I did study and read up a good deal before I went, so that I felt as prepared as I could be. And then, we had some good mentors. I had Lauren Blackburn was my chief of surgery at the 31st Cache. I had my colleague Jim Sebesta, who was a contemporary, but that we worked together all the time, and we figured things out. And after a few months of that kind of volume, you gained a comfort level.
So, Al, we would be amiss not to delve into some of the HIPAA type violations and everything, but you were involved in a very significant part of, I guess a small part, but a significant part in terms of the world, in terms of the capture of a very famous person. And can you tell us a little bit about the events that again, not going into the medical issues, but kind of what events led to you being involved in this particular person, and kind of how'd you get to see him, and kind of walk us through that process, and what was going through your mind during that time?
So, we're talking about the ace of spades, Saddam Hussein. Had a number of medical problems, which our group was called upon to deal with, and one of my partners actually was the primary surgeon that evaluated him on several occasions, and that's Jim Sebesta, and Jim invited me to be on the surgical team that managed his problems. And it was a very unique experience when he was kept at a secret sort of off-site location. When they brought him in, they didn't sort of say exactly when the time was, and they kind of cleared the hallway of the hospital when they brought him in. And so there was a lot of secrecy. He had a number of special operations that were guarding him. And he was brought to our emergency department, and I remembered a number of us, including the commander and deputy commander, as well as the surgical team and the anesthesia team, were all in this room, kind of off the side of the ER, and we were all sort of standing in the room waiting. And he comes in the room, and I'm the first one in the line, and just. There he is. It was like this individual that I'd seen on TV, hundreds of times shooting off a shotgun and so on.
Right.
And here I am shaking his hand, and subsequently in the recovery area after his operation, getting a hug from him, which was a very. From my standpoint, the first thing I would say is the extraordinarily charismatic, as you may have expected. Mm-hmm. Instantly dominated the room, mm-hmm. I think partly just because of who he was,
right.
And the personality, but immediately was like cracking jokes and putting everybody at ease, and he in one case made our DCCS a kind of interesting story. At the time, at a prior visit, was putting an IV in so he could get a CAT scan, and unbeknownst to him, had developed the detached retina, so was having trouble sort of focusing his eyes, and ended up missing the IV a couple times. And after the third try, apparently Saddam said to him, you need some help with that? and then later on at the subsequent meeting while I was there, when he said, hey, I'm Jack Childs, I met you before, and then Saddam said, aha, and pointed to his arm like this was the guy that had to stick me several times, and everyone started laughing, and Jack started saying, I had a detached retina, I'll forget it. He just kind of gave up, but very, very charismatic, very funny, as you might expect from somebody that's been in that position, the position of life that he had. But then the other unique part for me was seeing this individual in a moment of humanity and vulnerability. At the end of the day, here's another human being in need. And it was a very, very eye-opening experience.
Yeah, I'm sure to weigh that against some of the atrocities that you've seen and know that he's done to his people and everything like that. That's what a lot of people would often say to me. How can you deal with the enemy that comes through the door and operate on them or something like that? And I think what I've always justified is trying to say is that I just treat the person that comes through the door. I try to keep everything else in my mind and focus on the medical problems at hand. That's what they told us to do.
Correct. And it sometimes you did think about that at times. We certainly, I managed a number of insurgents or enemy combatants, if you will, and many times being brought in with the Americans that they had wounded,
right.
At the same time.
Right.
And so very difficult, but at the end of the day you say, this is a human being in need, and they get treated based on the priority of their injuries, just like everybody else.
Now, walk us back through kind of all your different deployments, and I think one of the things that a lot of people want to hear about is there, I've seen your case list, it's unbelievable, some of the things that you guys did through those years, especially through the search and everything like that, and obviously I was over there several times myself, but walk me through a case that stands out amongst the rest. I'm probably sure there's a lot of them, but is there something that you said to yourself, my God, like, how am I going to get out of this situation, or what am I going to do? And maybe not the specifics of the case as much as that, especially for the younger residents that find themselves, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the middle of a war zone or something like that, but we've all found ourselves in that situation where you're looking into a belly or you're doing something, you're saying to yourself, holy cow, this is, I don't know, how am I going to deal with this? And kind of how did you process through that?
So there's a couple cases that always stand out in my head when I think back about these those deployments. One was a young man that was wounded by a sniper on Baghdad International Airport, brought over to us with, you know, evisceration of his bowel, very very much in shock when he arrived, and remember some specific details about he had arrived out front. We had to run him down the hallway of the hospital and so on. But very short time in to get us into the OR, and I remember it was Lauren Backborn, Jim Sebessa, and I, and had sort of very significant injuries to his retroperitoneum and pelvis with, you know, as we say, sort of audible bleeding. And there were several points in the case where I felt, you know, we are just too far behind and we're not going to catch up. And the one, the thing that I remember that I think was the turning point for him was the administration of fresh whole blood. And this was a cavalry soldier. There was over 100 soldiers in his unit that lined up to donate blood. And when we got him to the ICU with sort of a packed abdomen, he was pouring blood out of his abdomen. And they brought up, I remember the nursing supervisor brought up these 6 units of blood and handed them to me. And I remember taking them and feeling they're still warm. Mm-hmm. And I said, what is this? And he's like, it's fresh blood. And we started transfusing these. I think we ended up transfusing him like 26 units of fresh blood. And I just watched the bleeding, sat at the foot of his bed and watched the bleeding from his abdomen stop. And I remember that was sort of the, for me, that was the catalyst that said, we have to rethink what we're doing in terms of resuscitation. And ultimately led to a protocol that was 1-to-1. It was only when John Holcomb sort of said sometime later after the deployment, we talked about what we had done. He said, you know, this kind of flies in the face of the way we've been resuscitating people for a while, and started looking at that data. So that was one case that always sticks in my mind that we saved. The other one was an individual that Jim Sebest and I managed who had suffered a gunshot wound, a young Iraqi in his teens, and had been treated by OBGYN residents that were the only physicians left at an Iraqi hospital. And they had done, they had done an operation on his abdomen and had a number of bowel injuries and the vascular injuries. And he ended up languishing on the service over at their hospital for several days, and basically broke down his bowel anastomoses and had developed a necrotizing infection that involved his groin. And when I remember, as we brought him over there, he had a cloud of flies around him that we, you know, kept having to buzz off and get off of him, and we couldn't get off of him. And when we eventually got down to the debridement, we were eyeball to eyeball with necrosis of the common femoral artery, and which I had not quite encountered before. And we sat there and looked at this and said, what are we going to, is that really necrosis or is it just staining? And we pretty much decided, no, I think he's got a necrotic wall. And so, and just the process of how are we going to deal with this? And remember the kind of back and forth that my colleagues had and said, you know, well, there's either one of two things are going to happen. It's going to thrombose, or he's gonna, it's gonna break down, he's gonna bleed. And so I said, well, we'll heparinize him. Once we got all the bleeding control, we'd heparinize him. And then we took a viable muscle flap and put it over the thing and said, look, let's let it sort of let him get cleaned up. Let's treat his sepsis. Let's sort of get him through the critical care phase. And maybe it'll be structurally sound enough, long enough that we can come back and reconstruct it when the field is cleaner and so on. And so we were kind of just making this up as we go along, and I remember calling Chuck Anderson, who was our vascular mentor, senior vascular surgeon, and I remember he was playing badminton in his backyard when I called. And I started describing the case, and about halfway through the case, he just started laughing, and he just kind of said, oh, what a case. And he kind of asked, what do you think I should do? And he said, I think I would do what you're doing. He's like, there's no guide here. You just kind of have to do what you think is right. And we covered this with this rectus femoris flap, I think it was, or vastus lateralis. I don't even remember a part of the quadriceps that we freed up from the knee and then flipped up over and it covered this artery. And sure enough, we ended up multiple washouts and debridements and bowel work and abdominal work. And all of a sudden, he started to clean up. He got better. The ARDS got better. And maybe about 3 weeks into the course, he was on the step-down unit. And middle of the night, phone ring. My partner, Jim Sebesta's phone rings. As he talks for a few minutes, I said, okay, I'll be right down. And about a minute later, my phone rings. And he says, hey, it's this guy's number. It's 2808 was his number. It's 2808. And I said, I know exactly what happened. And sure enough, he was in a big pool of blood. Mm-hmm. He'd finally broken this thing down. And so we said, well, we bent back, and everything was cleaned up, and it was just very focused area of necrosis. The rest of the artery looked fine. I said, well, we debrided it all, and we put on a vein patch. And I remember when we opened the artery, looking at it, and there was some partially organized thrombus on the artery, and said, hey, I'm glad we heparinized him, because he would have clotted this off. And we were sort of patting ourselves on the back. We put a vein patch on there. We thought it was good. And then 2 days later, he broke that down again. And so we ended up just ligating it. And he kept his leg. He had developed enough collaterals, I think, by then that he had a signal in his foot, and he kept his leg. And that case, I remember a couple years later, we got pictures of this guy. They had brought him the 10th cache had brought him back. They had took down his skin graft abdomen, they took down his colostomies, they did a component release and reconstructed his abdominal wall, and the kid ended up getting married and fathering a child with his one remaining skin grafted testicle. I mean, it was and it was a very proud day for me that we had worked for months on this guy and got him through this.
Now, so that was, such an amazing story, and you obviously don't see that kind of thing here in the United States. And my question is, what kind of things have you taken away from your deployment to bring back into your own practice here in Philadelphia, and also back in Madigan when you were there?
I think there was this time where we were deployed, this willingness to sort of think outside the box from the standard what we do, and oftentimes we would be willing to fall back on simple approaches to complex problems. That's number one. I also think that I am much more willing than many of my contemporaries to just take patients right to the OR for whatever reason, I have a lot less hesitation about just saying, the right place for this guy to be is in the OR. And we see these cases over and over again that we review. And people sort of say, we went to CAT scan, and then we went to IR, and then we went to this. And really, at the end of the day, you just say, why don't you just take them right to the OR? And I think that was something that we learned when we were in Iraq, is that willingness to say, sometimes the right place and the quickest place and most direct way to get an answer is to just go to the operating room.
Alec, one of the things that every surgical resident and training and everything goes through is these kind of the ATLS and the ATLS triage scenarios. Obviously, triage is a major component of dealing with overseas. And, we've had people that have had combat experience on before, on Behind the Knife. But I think it really, the thing that I think it relates now is we just look around the world, look at our own we had Dr. Lillimo on in terms of the Boston Marathon bombing and, other things, and it's coming closer and closer to home. So most general surgeons in training, or most general surgeons in many cases, may find themselves in a triage scenario one day. What's it like to really, you're not talking about the questions 1 through 5 that we've all seen in patient A, patient B, patient C, patient D. What's it like to triage patients for the first time, or maybe for real, and maybe look at a guy and say, they're expecting, and they're not going to make it. And what rolls through your head, and how do you deal with that, and how do you come to the point where you know you're doing the right thing medically, and you're not playing, God or whatever you want to be able to use? How do you get into that?
Well, it's certainly difficult. And the first time you triage, number one, the triage scenarios I experienced weren't what my perspective of from MASH, where you have a bunch of casualties laying in front of you and you're kind of going from one to one. They're kind of rolling through your door one at a time, and then, you know, six or eight come in, and then there's a little break, and then six or eight more come in. And so you're constantly, what I recall about the process was this constant reevaluation and this willingness to keep reevaluating these patients. The triage criteria we use were simple from that I found and I still use today is, you know, the GCS motor score, can you hold two fingers, and a radial pulse check. And if they have those two things, you can probably be assured they're going to be okay at least for a while, barring obvious any external bleeding or something going on like that. But it was a very challenging process. It was oftentimes very chaotic because of that sort of the mm-hmm. way the casualties would arrive. They wouldn't all just arrive at once. They would be rolling in sort of waves. And so you'd think you'd get the worst, you know, you'd have the worst set figured out, or the first set figured out, and then the second set come in, and all of a sudden you'd say, well, this guy's even worse than that guy, but he's salvageable. And the idea of making somebody expectant is also extraordinarily challenging and very difficult for both, for all providers at all levels sort of to deal with, and the realization that those, even though they're expectant, they still require some care. And so we had to rotate our nursing staff that were assigned to expectant patients through that because it was so difficult for them, because they're used to, we do everything for everybody. And to have a casualty that they say, well, we're not going to do everything for this person, we're going to just try and make them comfortable, it's challenging. And it was very difficult. Particularly if those casualties had any wherewithal, that they were still awake or alert and knew, you know, that they had been injured, that they were going to die, and that was very difficult. And so we had to rotate our nursing staff that care for those and the physicians through that. But the things I remember about triage, the lessons learned that I still think hold true are, number one, there's a senior officer that's the triage officer. He assigns the casualties, and that the surgeon or the provider that gets assigned a casualty has to stay with that casualty until he's reassigned. And what we found a couple times would happen is we'd have this trauma bay with four beds, and the one you would get assigned a patient, and you'd do an assessment and say, my guy looks okay, or he's not that bad, and then you see across the mm-hmm. bed on the other side of the bay somebody really struggling, and there's this tendency to want to gravitate and go over and help that other person, and then all of a sudden you've left your guy alone, and he may not be as you may not have completely evaluated him yet, he may not be scanned yet, and so that oftentimes led to problems. And we certainly, on review of the mass casualties that we saw, there was some cases at Balad Air Base where they had some problems because of people leaving their assigned person rather than being taken from the triage officer and assigned somewhere else. I don't know if I'm answering the question, but
so Dr. Bickey, one of the things we have is a segment called Tips and Tricks, where we ask our experts to take us through a particular clinical scenario. For you, what we'd like to talk about is just if you could just walk us, you know, briefly through a trauma laparotomy. What your approach is, let's say it's a penetrating injury, the guy's bleeding into his belly, how do you get in, how do you pack, just your technique for that.
So certainly if it's a traumatic injury that's isolated to the abdomen, you know, number one, attentiveness to where the round entered and where you think it ended up is key. But the initial steps of access are the same. I do not usually, depending on the patient's stability, I don't waste a lot of time with electrocautery. I use knife and Mayo scissors for the entry, particularly if the patient has any history of instability or any, you know, problem with instability. There's nothing in the abdominal wall that's going to cause the patient to bleed to death. And so the knife and the Mayo scissors to get through the fascia and into the abdomen as quickly as possible. And then the initial steps are as what's described, which is, you know, initially a packs in all, and most of what I found that the packing is doing is not necessarily tamponading. I think there is some role for that, but it's cleaning up all the, it's cleaning things up. It's cleaning up the blood and the clot, so you can sort of figure out where where the injury is. And knowing that trajectory or determining the trajectory of the bullet can give you the missile, if that's what it is, can help you figure out where to look initially.
Just because there's a lot of people that range from medical students all the way up. A few subtle points, if you could talk, what's your preference in terms of, do you eviscerate the bowel? Do you pull out the clot first? Do you put your packs in right as soon as you get in and as you see that blush of blood or bowel or things like that? What is your technique that you like to use?
So I think initially, if there's so much blood that it's at the top of the abdomen, or certainly if I get any that's pouring out as I've made my incision, I'm fairly rapidly getting packs in, and again, mostly to soak all that stuff up, but just simply you can't see what's going on until that stuff is soaked up. And a lot of times, whether it's evisceration or you are having one person retract the abdominal wall, the assistant retract on one side, and you sort of either eviscerate or sweep the viscera to your side and put packs over, mainly to clean up all the blood along the pericolic gutters and in the upper and lower quadrants, and then reversing that process, so you're holding up the abdominal wall, and your assistant is or your colleague is putting in packs on the other side. That's the initial move, and then I think the next step, and this has been talked about before, is determining am I in sort of big trouble here, or is this something that I can have time to deal with? And the sort of the big trouble is, a central mediastinal a central retroperitoneal hematoma, where you think I'm going to have great vessel injury in the abdomen, the moves have to start to be much more rapid, where you're going to get vascular control and so on. But that first, I don't think you oftentimes can make that first determination until you've cleaned up the field. And so I tend to try and eviscerate, or at least pull the viscera to my side and get packs in on both pericolic gutters, and then go from there.
Now, sir, we always end all our interviews with our final five questions. It allows the listeners out there to get an in-depth insight on how you really are. First question we have for you today is, when you are in the operating room, are you playing music? And if you are, what's on your iPod, or what music is playing?
So if it's my choice in the music, which usually it's not, I usually let the fellow my residents choose the music. I tend to favor, if we're listening to Spotify or one of the, Pandora, it's usually something from the, 90s, sort of grunge scene, Pearl Jam or Alice in Chains or something like that. But I'm always happy with, it's more what will I not choose to listen to, and generally country or rap is something I tend not to listen to as much. But I'm anything that's classic rock or 90s rock or even contemporary rock, and then certainly blues, and Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimi Hendrix, and the like.
Number two, I know your answer already, but do you have any talents or hobbies or other interests outside of the operating room, outside of medicine, that you'd be willing to share with us?
I do. I play a lot of different instruments. I've been playing the guitar for now almost 30 years, a lot of blues guitar, electric and acoustic, play bass guitar, and I play the drums, and more recently I learned piano when I was younger. I took piano lessons. I've been playing a lot more piano lately. My daughter is quite accomplished. Actually, she's nine. She plays violin, cello, and piano, and so she has far surpassed me on the stringed instruments. But I'm still teaching her some things on piano.
Yeah, although I must say, you're one of the few people who we've ever sat down and a song comes on the radio, I'm like, Al, play, and you're like, okay, there it is, right there, within about 5 seconds to be able to play it. So, underselling yourself in that aspect.
So number three, is there a particular favorite trip or vacation that stands out in your mind? Iraq and Afghanistan don't count.
My wife is family is from the Philippines, and I've been twice now to the Philippines with her family, and those trips have always been fantastic for me, just to see another culture, but also to be with somebody that her mom and dad that grew up there, and to have, you know, how much she went there many times as a kid, and to just sort of see the joy of her family when they kind of, it's like they're going home. And so those trips always stand out in my mind.
Number four, if you had not gone into surgery and a field outside of medicine, what field would you have gone into?
So my first declared major at West Point was English, and I think probably writing or journalism in some respects would have been my choice. I still like to do it a lot. I'm trying to write a book. It's slow coming, but I'm trying to write a book about my experiences and my deployments.
Last one, number five. If you could go back and meet yourself on your first day of surgical internship, what one single piece of advice would you give yourself, knowing what you know now?
Eat when you can, sleep when you can. No. I would probably say keep asking questions, keep reading, and keep being curious about your field. I'm always constantly challenged and surprised by things that I learn from, you know, residents and students, and I think sometimes you lose sight of that. I know I did during residency, where you become kind of tired. You're just kind of tired of the grind, and you start to lose a little bit of the perspective, the love of what we do as a surgeon. And I think it's important to kind of hold on to that.
Well, Al, I'd just like to thank you for taking the time out to kind of spend with us. Obviously, you're only 2 years ahead of me, but you've been a mentor of mine through college, through residency, and as my staff and as a friend, both inside and outside of medicine. And I cannot thank you for sharing a lot of these very intimate and personal details, as well as the tips and tricks and everything else with us today. And on behalf of all the listeners, thanks again for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we all hope you enjoyed our talk with Dr. Beagley this week on Behind the Knife. In the works, we have a few episodes coming up on rural surgery, as well as a few episodes on global surgery. But as always, if you have any great ideas for podcast episodes, especially with the new academic year in sight, please send them our way.
Until next time, dominate the day.